Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, former Republican Justin Amash, he tweeted out, you know, an interesting little bit. He said, based on my experience with Republican colleagues in the House, I suspect that many Senate Republicans are hearing the facts of this case for the first time. And this is basically what John Kennedy, the Republican senator from Louisiana, said yesterday, that, you know, well, we weren't really paying attention to this, and, you know, we had other things to do, and, you know, we're learning, which, I, you know, there's part of me that goes, are they giving like a false hope that maybe they're really doing their job and they're really paying attention, even though what we keep hearing is they're falling asleep and wanting to leave early and want to take the weekend off. Which, again, you know, just I don't know that it plays really well, you know, when the fate of our nation is in the balance. I don't know. I'm just not, you know, the falling asleep thing and the I know they're older guys, but you know what? This is history in the making. It's kind of important. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the day's event, I've asked James LeMond to come talk with us. James is the managing director of the Moscow Project over at the Center for American Progress. James, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So, what do you think of this this Amash quote that this he believes the first time they're hearing this stuff?
You know, part of me wants to just agree with it and think that oh, maybe there actually could be some really kind of thoughtful discussion and people actually listening in. You know, senators actually taking an honest approach to what happened. But I think outside of a very, very small select group of senators, Republican senators, that this is actually that may hold some potential swing votes. Overall, they mostly made up their mind, and frankly have been following what the you know, probably whether or not how much they follow the actual House conversations is probably frankly pretty limited. But what we may have seen is actually what we're likely to see is them kind of probably continue to fall in line. Essentially, I mean, McConnell himself has said at the front end of this that he is not an impartial juror,
right,
and that he's basically admitted to being part of the cover up.
Right, and he's saying, look, we're going to be coordinating with the White House, which is to me the admission of, yep, we're going to cover that. We're going to work to cover this up.
Right, I mean, I think that the facts of it are pretty simple, right? It's like Trump did it. We know that. All the evidence has pointed in that direction. Every witness has pointed in that direction. Every document that's been uncovered has pointed in that direction. To cover it up, he covered it. They conducted a massive cover up. They prevented Congress from obtaining documents. I mean, more documents. They prevented witnesses from testifying. Now the Republicans are engaging in that cover up, hand in glove with the White House.
Yeah, I keep coming back to it. I got to get the shirt made up, 5347. I got to get that shirt made up because I think that's what it's going to end up being, because I just don't see any Republican having the courage or the statesmanship to step forward and be anything other than in line.
You know, I think that that's the general kind of consensus, right? And I think that that's probably right. But it is helpful to, you know, at the same time, you can only kind of present the evidence as it exists, make the case to, you know, there's two audiences in that room, right? One is the senators who are going to vote, and then the other audience is the country who's going to vote for those senators.
Right.
And so the case needs to be made to both. You know, the public has the right and the responsibility to kind of understand what happened. And then, you know, we have to hope that at minimum there can be some pressure put on Republicans to actually do the right thing and put party above or put country above party.
Oh yeah, you would think, but here's the thing that gets me is, you know, everybody hated Donald Trump. I mean, this is the weird part of this, and there's part of me that goes, there's got to be something bigger at play here than just they're afraid of the base. Because every one of them in the primary, you know, bashed him. Lindsey Graham said it'd be the end of the party. Ted Cruz went out. Every one of these senators who are now in lockstep, part of the 53, they've said things to bash him. In fact, there was at one point right after the election where there was, you know, a Republican thought that the Republicans would impeach him. So this is just a weird kind of moment for me where you go, how do you get someone like Lindsey Graham, who was, you know, extraordinarily critical of him and said some really horrible things, or Mitt Romney, who at the Aspen Institute had not a nice word to say about him, now walking right behind Mitch McConnell.
So I think in many ways it reveals the problem, the existing broken political system that exists in America, right? So part of the reason is we have, you know, in the House you have gerrymandered districts that are largely, you know, the competition takes place within the party. So you have to, you know, and who wins party primaries? It's the more extreme, more radical elements within. So it is essentially the base. It is the Trump base that follows him. And then in the Senate, it's not all that different, even in the larger states, where, especially in the South, and you know, you have you're talking about Lindsey Graham, right? You have the kind of the South Carolina primary is the main kind of race that is happening, as opposed to a real kind of competition between the ideas. And I think that's just a result of kind of hardened politics, where you know, it used to be you had northeastern. Republicans who were liberal. You had Southern Democrats who were conservative, and those just don't exist anymore. And it's just everything's just falling along on party lines. And that, I think that actually speaks to some of the differences we're seeing now with what happened during Watergate, where the party politics was a little more complicated and things didn't just break down so clearly along those party lines.
Yeah, but you know, I look at someone like Donald Trump who doesn't fit the conservative ideology in any way, shape, or form. Now, granted, he's basically doing. He's got everybody else doing his homework, so he's carrying a lot of their water. But, you know, he's not a conservative. He's not an evangelical. He's none of these. He doesn't fit any of those things, but yet they're defending him to the hilt.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a question of what does it mean to be a conservative. I think this is something that maybe I'm not the best position to kind of speak to them about, because as someone who does not identify as a conservative, but I do think it is like the question of do conservatives believe in in free markets and pro business and international order and a strong national defense, or do they believe in preventing immigration? Do they believe in racism and bluster and this kind of ideology of one? And it is Donald Trump. I mean, he is not governing as a conservative in terms of a policy framework of you know, pro business, free market capitalism. He is governing as serving the party of one, and that party is Donald Trump.
Excellent point. And you're absolutely right. But, you know, I look at this and I don't want to be I don't want to sound conspiratorial, and it does. It sounds conspiratorial. But I look at 53 U.S. senators all in lockstep who at one point hated this guy, all in line. And it makes me wonder, when the Russians hacked into the DNC, did they hack into the RNC too? I mean, it just seems like there's got to be something there that's keeping people in line. I mean, and you look at even the defense here. There's Russian fingerprints all over Trump's defense as well.
So I mean, we actually do know that the Russians did hack into the RNC. They just chose not to, targeted the RNC, and they just chose not to pursue that path. So I do think it's. This is not to suggest that every single senator is being blackmailed by Russian intelligence. No, but I do think that senators tend to move in numbers and find safety in numbers. And, you know, it's just as they all opposed Donald Trump in 2016, then he got the nomination and they got behind him and then started governing and they all got behind him, all in a big pack, right? They move kind of like zebras with safety in numbers and moving together. So if something were to break, and again, I'm not saying this is going to happen, this is not a prediction, but I think that, you know, we need to kind of think about, if we walk into this process with the result preordained, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah.
And so I think to the extent that, the House managers make the best case and to the American public, and then the American public, everyone should be calling their senators. If you feel strongly one way or the other, whatever it is, let that voice be heard. Congressional offices, like everyone thinks that, it's some idealistic kind of idea to call your senator or write to your senator. It's like they have people marking down what topics people are care about, what senators, what congressmen care about is getting reelected, and what are they, and how do they know what, how do I get reelected? By doing what people that elected them sent them to do. And so they have people who mark down tally sheets of what issues people are calling about on their position. Like this, the people actually do care when constituents call and complain about an issue or voice their opinion. So I would encourage everybody to call your senator, call your congressman regularly about this issue.
Yeah, put it on your phone and keep it right there on your speed dial. Call early, call often. But here's the thing: I'm looking at the Democratic managers laying out the case and doing it in a very methodical, fact-driven way. I'm looking at the Republicans, which just seems kind of slapdash. It doesn't seem like there's an actual defense, except and I love this one. And maybe you can talk to this a little bit, because we know that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. But there's this other side of it going, well, if the Russians did, then the Ukrainians did too. Or it wasn't the Russians. It was just the Ukrainians. I've heard both stories. I'm curious if you've heard the same thing.
Definitely. So to your first point about the actual, what the defense is in the Senate that we're seeing right now, frankly, there really isn't one. It's kind of incredible where Trump's lawyers are not really putting up much of a defense. And essentially it boils down to the president can do what he wants. And that, Alan Dershowitz has been out there saying that if there's no crimes committed, then there's no, then you can't be impeached. And that is just not true. I mean, you were hard pressed to find a constitutional legal scholar who would say that. I mean, Alan Dershowitz himself has said that during the Clinton impeachment. And even the witnesses that were called during the House proceedings said as much, impeachable offenses and crimes are not the same. There's overlap, but they're not the same. But the thing that frightens me and what we saw in the House was that the defense was essentially a conspiracy theory that we know originated with Russian intelligence. And this is the theory that you previewed that shows that says that no, the real collusion in 2016 wasn't between Trump and Russia. It was actually between the Democrats and Ukraine. And there's this whole convoluted story about the DNC server actually being in Ukraine because CrowdStrike brought it there. And this makes no sense because CrowdStrike is a California-based company. The DNC didn't even have a server. It was a cloud-based system, so there's no actual physical server to be brought anywhere anyways. And we actually know it came from Russian intelligence because through the Mueller investigation. Recently released memos. This is not even part of the report. This is just secondary memos that came forward through Freedom of Information requests from BuzzFeed and CNN. I revealed that, no, the first time Trump had heard that was back in 2016. And then we heard it from Paul Manafort, who we all know had worked for Russian interests in Ukraine, and Konstantin Kalimnik, an individual who has been identified by the FBI as having ties to Russian intelligence. He went through GRU training and has been working with pro-Russian forces and Paul Manafort in Ukraine for over a decade.
So it's got Russian fingerprints all over it, is what you're saying.
This is a Russian disinformation campaign that the president and Republicans now, as a result, are perpetuating.
So is it that they've both come to the same conclusion, or do you think that somehow someone's leaking this stuff to Rudy or to whomever? Could this be part of the secret meeting with Trump and Putin? Where do you see this stuff coming from, though?
I mean, I don't like conspiracy theories.
I don't either. That's why I'm trying to get out of the conspiracy realm because I hate this kind of we don't know.
Right, and I think the part of the reason I don't necessarily believe in conspiracy theories generally is that the information tends to come out through one way or another, and I think that's what we've seen, right? So the way the flow of information appears to me based on the research we've done. Is that it went from Konstantin Kalimnik, who again is has the FBI has publicly identified as having ties to Russian intelligence, through the Trump campaign and to the candidate himself, and the president himself, and the president likes that, like the idea. He probably because one of the things it does is not only that it throws Ukraine as kind of the perpetuator, but it also absolves Russia of any crimes.
Right.
It also absolves the Trump team of any crimes. So he latches onto it, and like we were saying before, how Republicans have just been falling in line with President Trump. That they got their marching orders, and they are now perpetuating it. What scares me, and why I think this is so frightening, is that they've been warned that this is a Russian misinformation campaign. They've been warned by Fiona Hill, who was a Trump administration appointee. She was a senior director for Russia and the top advisor on Russia. Worked in the National Security Council, testified in the House proceedings, and she lectured the House Republicans about this. And what do they do? They continue to perpetuate it. Same thing. Tom Bosser, who was Trump's Homeland Security advisor, briefed the president on this repeatedly, saying, "No, this is bogus. There's no actual fact pattern behind this. There's no reason to believe this. It is a Russian disinformation campaign." Yet, what does the president, what does defenders continue to do? They continue to perpetuate this, and that's why it's so frightening. Is that we have been warned that this is literally the result of an adversary perpetuating a attack on the United States, and our elected officials are continuing to push the same line.
It's incredible. I mean, again, you know, it's as I'm watching who I assume are supposedly good lawyers that Trump has and the Republican has make this argument. I keep going. These are actual lawyers, because again, it's incredible to me that this is what they've come prepared with. That there's no actual defense of what I say is an actual crime, which is getting back to, which we haven't talked about at all, is holding up the money that was supposed to go to Ukraine, which the General Accountability Office is saying was a crime.
That's right. There were a series of crimes committed in the process. I mean, that's what makes the Dershowitz kind of defense such a joke. I mean, there's two reasons it's a joke. One is because it's the actual logic and analysis is incorrect, but it's also a joke because the actual facts are wrong. There were crimes. The holding up of the military assistance to Ukraine has been deemed a crime by the Government Accountability Office. Bribery has likely been committed. Criminal conspiracy. A violation of honest services fraud. The list goes on and on, where there have been a series of crimes that you know, official government institutions have declared. these are not random influencers on Twitter who were, I think this could actually have been a crime if he had done X, Y, and Z. It's like, no, these are actual government institutions making these declarations.
Yeah.
And so it is repeatedly mind-boggling that this is the only defense they have, because it just doesn't even hold up.
The other side of it is they don't have a defense. So what I'm waiting for now is they've done a whole bunch of disinformation, as you've said. What they need now is kind of like a catchy little slogan. Maybe dig up Johnny Cochran from the OJ trial. Something like, if Trump throws a fit, you must acquit. Something like that to keep us stupid and focused on something else.
Yeah, I'm curious what the actual they'll have their the Trump lawyers have their opportunity to present their case. I believe it's most likely going to happen on Saturday, and I think if I'm very curious to see what they actually say. My guess is, frankly, that they actually probably try to dismiss the entire process and don't actually put up much of an argument. One, because they don't have much of an argument. Two, they, based on the performance earlier this week, they seem incredibly unprepared. They looked like almost deer caught in the headlight after listening to Adam Schiff and the House managers. And then three, I think it's part of a messaging campaign to kind of dismiss the proceedings as illegitimate or partisan, witch hunt. Inflammatory rhetoric of choice.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably the direction they're going to go in. But I'm very curious to see what actually.
Me too. There's a lot I'm curious about. You see it as a caught a deer in the headlights kind of thing. I see it as they know this is in the bag, so they can mail it in. They know the cover-up is there, so, you know, I'm going to collect the paycheck anyway. What I'm really looking for is the 16 hours that Republican senators are going to get to ask questions. I'm really interested to see what questions they decide to go after. Will it be about Hunter Biden and Burisma, and will it be that kind of a sideshow, which, to me, that's not even part of this issue. This is clearly Trump, strong-arming a foreign leader to open up an investigation, and he was holding back money. To me, it's that simple. It is a straight line from one to the other.
Absolutely. Trials are not about trading witnesses so that you can kind of score political points. It's about developing and proving a fact pattern.
Yep.
And whether or not someone has actually committed the crimes that they've been charged with. And the entire kind of Hunter Biden appearance was always just kind of a red herring that they were trying to distract and basically,
yep,
essentially feed into the Trump's original goal of creating a kind of political damage for his opponent by suggesting that there was something actually behind this whole quote investigation.
Yeah, we'll see how this plays out. As it continues, we'd love to have you come back and share some more thoughts, especially when the Republicans get to ask questions. I'm really interested to see what kind of brainiac questions they come up with.
I'd love to come back anytime.
Good stuff, James. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
James Lamond, Managing Director of the Moscow Project. Make sure you check out their work. They have done some painstaking work in laying out the timeline of this from the beginning. At themoscowproject.org. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day when 20 laborers who were part of the Civilian Conservation Corps got involved in a type of labor they probably never expected. The Civilian Conservation Corps was a program established by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to get young men back to work during the Great Depression. The program employed men ages 18 to 26 to complete public works projects across the nation. CCC crews planted nearly 3 billion trees, constructed 470 fire towers, built 97,000 miles of fire roads, and constructed facilities at 800 parks across the nation. But snowy weather had ground work to a halt in Allegheny County, Maryland. The men of Company 324 were at the 15 Mile Creek camp waiting for the weather to clear. That's when they received a distress call. A woman was trapped due to the snow. She was in labor, but the 3 mile long access road where she lived was impassable. Even worse, the state's snowplows were busy digging out other roads. The men of the CCC answered the call. 20 volunteers shoveled the snow by hand, working well into the night so the trapped woman could make it to the hospital to deliver her baby. In total, 30,000 young men working in 200-man crews participated in the CCC in Maryland from 1933 to 1942. Due to its proximity to Washington, D.C., the state was designated the first core area. The CCC men helped to build campgrounds, pavilions, and hiking and skiing trails that greatly enhanced the recreation landscape of that state. But for one woman, they were remembered for helping her when she needed it most, during the birth of her child on a snowy day in January. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we speak, Donald Trump is rubbing elbows with the Republican National Committee, who've pumped about $500,000 into his pocket as he's down in Miami at the Doral Country Club or whatever they call it. He's down there rubbing some elbows, and you gotta service the customers, right? And this is again another one of those moments where you go, explain to me how it is that we're spending all of this money of tax dollars, shuffling him around to his properties so that he can cash in and not be any bit upset about it. I don't know. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the big news of the day, I got our good friend, former Congressman Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Rick, you are officially blue collar. You know why?
Why is that?
It's Doral.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Doral.
Yeah. Sorry.
You are officially blue collar. Yeah.
and I don't golf. I'll tell you, the last time I golfed was about 10 years ago. My father-in-law took me out golfing. I had a hole-in-one. He never golfed with me again.
Well, you really opened this one up for me. The last time I golfed, I went to prison.
Oh, well, and there's a picture of that, too.
Yes, the golf trip, yeah. And I didn't golf. I really didn't. Golf when I got over there, I didn't golf, period. I was so bad I didn't own clubs. But anyway, yeah, so I don't golf. Yeah.
But you got the picture anyway.
Right.
Probably not a great memory though. But look, you know, am I the only one who seems to think that, you know, when he was running around on the campaign trail saying he's never going to golf, he's never going to have time, and then all he seems to do, I think someone pegged it at like one out of every 6 days, he's golfing, or one out of every 5 days mm-hmm. he's golfing.
Yeah. The only time I wished I would have golfed was I got a phone call, and they asked if I wanted to be in a golf foursome with President Clinton. And I said, I don't golf. They said, well, you don't have to be good. I said, no, you don't understand. I don't golf. I don't pick up clubs.
Okay.
Know? That would have been cool, though.
Yeah, I mean, I would have butchered and hacked my way through it and done a bunch of kicking and throwing and all of that. But it would have been. And look, here's the thing, and I know I'm going to take, you know, guff for this. I would golf with Trump just for the experience.
Right, exactly. Why not?
You know, maybe I could whisper in his ear and tell him, hey, you know, maybe undo all the horrible things you've been doing to organized labor, and maybe he'd do it. Because I don't think he has an ideological bone in him. I think wherever the goes, man.
Yeah. He's all over the place and then changes.
You know, whatever's going to get him a crowd to applaud and pat him on the back, you know, mm-hmm. I think that's it.
Right.
So let's get to the big news, the impeachment. Thoughts so far? Have you seen a defense out of the Republicans yet?
Well, the Republicans are, you know, taking the tack that, you know, most of them, not all of them, but most of them, you know, that nothing's wrong. This is, you know, a hoax and on, which I thought that the tack that they ought to take was that the call was not good. It was not proper. You don't bring up opponents, but it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment. I mean, you could actually take that tack. They haven't done that. It's just more or less of you haven't presented your case. You're repeating the same thing, you know, is basically what they've said.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. The Chief Justice saying, okay, you both sides, you don't have enough Senate decorum. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, because you got people falling asleep during the trial.
Well, he was saying how they, you know, talk with each other, but I kind of thought, you know, I mean, it's politics, and that's life, and that's debate, and it's a big deal. So, you know, you just can't go in there and say, oh, my distinguished friend, you know, all day long. So I would expect there's going to be confrontation.
Yeah. I would expect there'd be some heat. At least I would hope. I mean, because I'm looking at this, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, but I'm looking at this as, you know, the Republican, you know, Trump's lawyers haven't really done a great job of putting forth any type of defense. And it seems like they're horribly unprepared. And it just appears to me like they know the fix is in. And, you know, we'll just mail it in. It'll be fine. It'll be over. It'll be over before the State of the Union. And it's already done.
Yeah, I mean, I think their tactic is like somebody that's in a debate that is ahead. So, you know, just don't do anything in the opposite direction. Just, you know, doesn't matter what you really say that night during the debate. Just keep moving. And I think that's what their, you know, their tact is.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that they can end this by the State of the Union, to be honest with you.
Oh, I fully expect it. I fully expect this to be over by the end of the month. And Trump to be able to say at the State of the Union that he was exonerated, and that, you know, that just being the message that comes out of that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
No, we'll see. I mean, you know, the Republicans do have some 16 hours of questioning that they have to come up with. And as I said earlier, I think it's going to be interesting to see if they come up with any actual questions, or if they're questions mm-hmm. about Hunter Biden and Burisma and all kinds of other stuff that I don't think are. No, I don't think they're pertinent to this, to what he's being impeached for.
I don't think they'll have a lot of questions. I really don't. And, you know, the person that's benefiting the most out of this, I think, is Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Because Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are stuck in D.C.
Oh, good point. But ultimately, I mean, you know, isn't this kind of a hit for him, though, that, you know, he's in the middle of what, you know, this, well, you did something wrong? And he's you know, he's having to defend himself over his actions with Ukraine while he was VP?
Well, I mean, I've always argued that it's not the best situation for Biden. I don't think this is a, you know, a silver bullet or anything. I really don't. But it's something that's there and, you know, will be exploited. And, you know, so it's there. Yeah. And again, he's probably not suffered too much from this. But then again, if all that stuff starts coming up on national TV, then it's not, you know, super helpful for him. But, you know, he and Buttigieg and Klobuchar are out there being able to, you know, be out on the trail in Iowa. Of course, if you look historically, winning Iowa does, except for Barack Obama and Jimmy Carter. Everybody else who's won Iowa never went on to win the presidency.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays.
As far as I remember. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and Iowa's become an interesting place because up until Reagan, as I remember it, you know, no one had not won Iowa and gone on to get their party's nomination. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's all been backwards. So it's a weird thing that we've seen there in Iowa. And look, I think Sanders has got an uphill climb. Iowa and New Hampshire are very white states. He should do very well. Where he struggles is with the African-American community, and I don't really know why, other than today the Daily Beast came out with an article that they've unearthed, you know, him talking about slavery and comparing workers to slaves. And, you know, the labor movement has used the frame of wage slavery for forever. So, you know, they're trying to tie him to, you know, he was talking about slavery, and we can't talk about slavery, again, to enrage the African-American community against him.
Well, and that I don't understand. I mean, I know we are in a hypersensitive society today where you, as my dad, who's going to be 97, says, you can't say anything anymore. I know it's hypersensitive, but we, people in the labor movement, myself, others, we have always talked about slave labor in China, that is slave labor. And we've talked about, you know, companies that try to institute slave labor. And Rick, I've never looked at that as a racial thing. Slavery is bad.
Yep.
And so then when you say it's slave labor, I mean, what? I don't know what you're supposed to say. It's bad labor practices. Slave labor has always been used, that word, and I just don't see where it would be a racist connotation by Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, but it's making its way around the Twitters as we speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are, how dare he? And you go, did you read the article? He didn't necessarily say it was the slave era of the country. Talking about slavery. Slavery has been going on since the beginning of time.
Right.
But, you know, hey, you know, as you've said, we're in that moment. So right. I think Sanders can do well early. I think he's going to struggle in the southern states, and I think that's going to hurt him.
Right.
But, we'll see how it plays out. You know, I think Biden has that segment of the voting populace pretty much wrapped up because he was the VP for Barack Obama. I mean, who else are you going to go for? But did you see, since we're talking about the candidates, did you see Hillary Clinton this week, the interview she did?
I was, you know, in news notes I put out to some stations this week, and I wasn't on your show that day, but I put it out to you. And in there I put, because sometimes I add headlines, you know, to the radio stations, as you know. And on that day, I said, I'm not even putting a headline on this one. I found it honestly unbelievable. First of all, if you look at, and I can back up what I'm saying on this one. There was an article about a year and a half ago that actually said, although Bernie didn't author, you know, bills that zip through the system, Bernie was one of the most successful people in the Senate of getting things passed that he wanted.
Right.
Bernie Sanders came to me with the most amazing idea for the cost of living increases for seniors to totally revamp how it's decided to give them a cost of living increase. He was in my office. He had his usual stack of tons of papers, right? And at the end, I said, Bernie, this is genius. This is so good, so fair for senior citizens. I said, yes, put me on the bill. And he looked at me and he said, I want to pass the bill. Why don't you do the bill? I'll go on it. And I said, okay. And he said, yeah, it's not pride of authorship. I want the bill passed. That's Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Number two about Hillary's article. So he has gotten things accomplished. He may not have his name all over them. He's done it. Number two, you know, a lot of people like Bernie Sanders. A lot. Even people that don't agree with him like Bernie Sanders. And because he's honest, what you see is what you get. You know, I worked with him on endless press conferences on trade issues, you know, fighting the unfair trade practices. People do like Bernie. So I think this was just, in my opinion, just a bitter, it was a bitter article. Then at the end, Hillary Clinton did the escape valve. Oh, well, you know, I thought I was supposed to be basically, you know, unvented. Oh, of course, I'm going to support it, you know, a day later.
But right. Here's the thing. When I saw it, I'm like, well, I don't really think he wants your outward endorsement because, look, you know, ideologically, there's some big differences. She's a hawk. He's mm-hmm. not. You know, she's a kind of a centrist Democrat. He's not. So, you know, I was like, Bernie's like, okay, I think Bernie would be happy with that. But what I saw
she lost because she liked trade deals and everybody knew it.
That's it.
That's one of the reasons she lost
absolutely.
Pennsylvania and Wisconsin.
And her whole idea of having a trade prosecutor, which at the time I said, you know, is not a bad thing. We should be enforcing the laws. It was weak and it was a halfway right. measure. Sanders was saying, no, we're gonna go and we're gonna redo them. But you know, the thing for me is this is reopening some wounds from 2016, and I saw this as just sour grapes and a way to really hammer on and on the coattails of the claim that he said that a woman can't win. And mm-hmm. this was, you know, one of those things to get, you know, the Hillary voters all enraged about the Bernie bros who evidently harassed them during 2016. And, you know, who knows if those were actually Sanders supporters or Russian trolls. I don't know. But, you know, this was planned. This was calculated. This wasn't, because Hillary Clinton is a smart woman. She doesn't just go off the cuff and say something stupid like this for no reason.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, this wasn't something that just was a slip. This was calculated. I think, you know, if this continues in a lot of ways, especially after there's a Democratic nominee, then it's a circular firing squad. And if they go into the convention with chaos, like it was last time with the head of the Democrat National Committee, Wasserman Schultz, stepping down before the gavel banged, you know. If that all happens again, it's a circular firing squad, and Donald Trump will have his hand on the Bible in D.C.
No, I've already said I think he's going to be reelected anyway, because what you're seeing is the circular firing squad. Did you see the New York Times endorsed both Elizabeth Warren right. and Amy Klobuchar and went into reasons why they've chosen both? Because, well, you know, if we want to go really progressive, then we go with Elizabeth Warren. But if we want to go centrist, middle of the road, we're going to go with Amy.
Right. And, of course, it was obvious they were going to endorse two women no matter what. There would not be a male endorsed. I mean, if anything, just if they want to endorse Elizabeth Warren, endorse her. But then to turn around and just say, well, we are going to endorse two women. I don't know. It was the New York Times trying to get a following. I'm not sure. It was unusual at best. So, you know, I think they should have just, picked one of them.
Pick one.
That was a weird endorsement. Very weird.
Pick one. I mean, I'll be honest. I'm backing Bernie Sanders for one reason and one reason alone. I think he has the best labor record of any person sure. in the race by far.
Sure.
As a union
Absolutely.
Guy, he is by far the best candidate on labor issues. Would I be upset if Elizabeth Warren were the candidate? Not even in the slightest.
Mm-hmm.
But Sanders is the person that I think is best for labor mm-hmm. and for the issues that I think are important.
And as I tell people that, and I said this, in fact, it hit pretty viral with 100,000 hits when I said it. I was at the Democratic National Convention when I said this. Bernie Sanders, people are going to go in the election booth and say, Clinton, Trump, Clinton, Trump. If they went in, it would be easier for some people to have said Sanders for several reasons. There'd be a Republican Senate to, quote, balance him, if you want to look at it that way. But the trade issue, I argue to this day,
yep.
Hillary beat Trump with the popular vote. Sanders would have been with the popular vote. But I argue to this day that Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, you know, Michigan, I think would have been a different ball game, because Bernie Sanders was the same as Trump. Hillary Clinton wasn't the same as Bernie Sanders and Trump on trade. I argue Bernie Sanders possibly could have won the last election.
No, I argue he would have won, because you're right. Mm-hmm. Trump did steal Labor's message on the
Absolutely.
Trade deals. He did steal Sanders' message on, you know, the poor rural communities that have just been
right.
decimated by deindustrialization.
Right.
And look, Hillary Clinton didn't really speak to any of that.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to relitigate 2016, but I just thought it was just sour grapes to bring up. And I wish she would just go away at this point.
And now these weird things happen in the New York Times, and then all of a sudden, the Hillary Clinton statement, which what's that joke? A place, the Onion or the Beat, Babylon Bee or something?
No, the Onion.
A fake site.
Yeah.
I seriously thought it was the Onion. I did. I really did.
Yeah, I was waiting for the, you know, because I added the line, because the headline was Clinton says nobody likes Bernie Sanders, and I added, and his mother dresses him funny. I was expecting that to be the headline.
Right.
But, you know, just, well, it's going to be an interesting couple of months.
It will.
Most certainly. Bob, I appreciate the time, as always.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff, man.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, absolutely. Our good friend Bob Ney. Let's take a quick break right back. But seriously, I thought, like Bob said, it was an Onion thing, in that, you know, nobody likes him and his mother dresses him funny and doesn't comb his hair. Oh, just is what it is. I'm going to take a quick break right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.